but an extra pair of hanging handles and ankle braces.
Sandra leans over to scrutinize the pattern, adjusting her reading glasses.
My Bernard could make you a wooden frame. It'll have to be good and strong. Don't want something like that collapsing when you're taking it for a ride, you know? Yeah,
Rose says, taking the magazine from Liza, her smile barely subdued, her eyes glinting with amusement as they flow over the page in her hands. In a sudden flurry of motion, she tosses it in my direction and it smacks me in the face, falling open on my lap.
What do you think, Doc?
I should probably give her a sharp glance, a cutting look. Say something about how I'm technically still her doctor, or at least offer a bland and non-committal response. But as I look down at the photo of the crocheted hanger, I can actually picture it. Picture her. Her tongue leaving a trail of moisture across her lower lip. Her legs spread wide, her pussy glistening with arousal in the dim light of my room. Those dark eyes of hers, full of desire, feral with need for my...
So, think it'll work?
When I look up, it's the first time I see a glimmer of apprehension flash across Rose's face. I clear my throat, the trace of a burn still lingering from the lemonade. I think... I trail off, drawing out her doubt before I finally give her the barest hint of a conspiratorial smile. I think you should use a thermal stitch for the base. It's sturdy, could support the weight of a 6'4" adult male, theoretically. Rose's eyes dance in the morning light that streams through the blinds.
Even all beast mode muscly?
I swallow a laugh as I set the magazine aside and resume my stitches. Though I try not to blush, I'm probably failing, judging by the heat coursing beneath my skin. I mean, theoretically. There's a single beat of silence, and then the women around me cackle. Though it takes a minute for my smile to really break free, it still does when I spot Ma dabbing at tears with the tissue she always keeps folded beneath her bra strap, or when Tina wheezes sex swing and laughs so hard she has to shuffle to the bathroom.
Well, thank God.
Liza says as she pulls a flask from her bag and dumps a generous splash of vodka into her lemonade, stirring the mixture with the end of her crochet hook.
We were starting to wonder if you were going to run back to Ireland and join the priesthood.
I roll my eyes. I'm not joining the priesthood.
Valid concern.
Liza shrugs and downs a third of her glass.
We'd be heartbroken to lose you, especially when you finally come out of your shell a little bit these last 2 weeks.
I try to think back on last week's meeting and what I said or did that was any different than the times I've been here before. I know I didn't explicitly say anything about how Rose broke into my clinic or how I rode with her in the ambulance to the hospital. But maybe I did open up a little more than usual when I told him about scrubbing in for a surgery. Maybe I did say something about a patient I was worried about. A case that was weighing on my mind. Liza smiles as though she can see where my thoughts have gone, and the conversation eventually veers to other topics, other gossip. We spend a couple of hours there, and I finish the blanket I intend to donate to the hospital and then start a new one, soliciting guidance from the group for the difficult jasmine stitch. When noon rolls around, everyone packs up, and I help Rose to her feet before I take her bag alongside my own and we leave to a chorus of final advice about the sex swing. At first, we walk in silence. It's hard to know how to start. What to say? I know I'm good at diagnosing illnesses and treating injuries in the precision and science of medicine. But with Rose, I feel out of my depth. Do I start with the suture sisters or the whole sex wing fiasco? Or do I go head on with tackling the subject of Eric Donovan? But while I'm overthinking my options in silence, Rose just dives right in.
Hey.
A brief smile passes my lips. Maybe it doesn't have to be so complicated. Hey.
I like the Suture Sisters.
Yeah, they're entertaining. Not what I expected when I went to my first meeting. I thought I'd be stitching up wounds for a woman's fight club or roller derby. Not just stitching. I glance down my shoulder at her and Rose is grinning, clearly pleased with herself. How'd you find out about that?
I saw a flyer on the bulletin board outside Wesley Pharmacy the other day. Thought I might check it out. Imagine my surprise when I called and Sandra mentioned your name.
You were not surprised at all, were you?
The doily kind of gave you away.
Much less lethally cool than the pina colada scent giving away an eyeball stabbing incident. Rose shrugs around her crutch pads.
I don't know. Those crochet hooks could do some damage.
And while we're on the topic of crochet, a sex swing? Seriously?
I figured it would be a good distraction. It worked.
You're nuts.
I've been living with you for a week, and I killed a guy yesterday, and you're just figuring that out now? I still think we need to revisit the conversation about your credentials, Dr. Kane.
Though I tried to give her a chastising look, it doesn't really stick. Not when I see so much worry and unease hidden beneath her teasing smile.
Can I ask you a question?
Always. It takes her a long moment of watching me before she says.
You could have turned me in. Or called the cops. You could have driven me straight to the station.
I shrug when she says nothing further. I could have, sure.
So, why didn't you? Why did you help me?
Because you asked me to, I say, and her whispered plea in my clinic resurrects itself from where it lies just beneath the surface of my thoughts. I'm sure she has no idea how much it has stuck with me, how sometimes I still hear it in my dreams. Rose watches me, doubt written into the crease that appears between her brows.
Most people would have said no.
I might look like most people, but I'm not.
Trust me.
She says with an eye roll.
You do not look like most people.
A dusting of blush rises in her cheek, and she turns away. Even though I know I shouldn't let it, my heart still flips over in my chest with this quiet admission that she might look at me and like what she sees. Rose waits until her blush is gone before she faces me once more.
This whole thing with Eric, the river... What if this all goes tits up?
What if it does? I've asked myself that many times over the past 2 days. Try to imagine what life would be like if anyone discovered my role in Eric Donovan's demise. But the thing that surprises me the most is how much I think about the opposite question. What if it doesn't?
But you could get in so much shit.
You could get in even more shit.
Yeah...
Rose says, drawing the word out.
That's definitely the truth.
This thing with guys like Eric, have you been at it for a while? I ask, thinking of the plants and the postcard with the cryptic note on her dresser.
Kind of.
Her head swivels, and she squints into the distance, her gaze landing across the street on a couple plucking weeds from a flower bed near their driveway.
Maybe not the time and place to get into details, but I used to just supply the means, if you know what I'm talking about. But now I'm trying to take on a more active role. Didn't work out once.
You mean Matt? Rose shakes her head and looks away, but not before I catch a glimpse of a glassy sheen in her eyes. My hand tightens around the straps of our bags to keep myself from reaching for her. Before I can say anything reassuring, she takes a deep and cleansing breath, then manufactures a brittle smile.
Anyway,
she says, clearing her throat.
I don't want to make you uncomfortable in your own home. Would you like me to go?
Stop asking me that, please. I'm not uncomfortable with you there. I leave out the part about how strange it was to wake up to her absence today, or how much I like what she's done to the guest room. I'm not used to it, but I don't dislike it.
Round of applause for Dr. McSpicy Beast Mode on his exemplary performance of a compliment.
Rose booms in a theatrical ringmaster tone, pausing long enough to let go of a crutch and sweep her hand toward an imaginary audience.
And now, for our next magic trick, witness Rose Evans's disappearing self-esteem.
Though I snort a laugh at the oohs and ahs she mimics from her circus spectators, My stomach still drops with the weight of her words. I like you.
I can sure tell.
It just takes some getting used to having someone else in my home. Not because of the thing that happened. I mean just generally. I've become accustomed to being alone, I guess. I shrug and I can feel her watching, the way she hunts through my expression like she can burrow right into my mind. And sometimes I think she does. She gets inside and pulls every loose thread, unraveling sutures through old wounds, opening them up to look inside. It's as though she's tearing my thoughts apart stitch by stitch, until I don't recognize the pattern of who I'm supposed to be.
What was she like?
Rose asked softly. My steps slow and she matches my pace. When I look down at her with a question tugging at my brows, she gives me a sad smile.
The woman who broke your heart, what was she like?
My step falters on a crack in the pavement. How does she figure me out like this? I don't have anything of Claire in my home. I left it all behind when I fled Boston. There's nothing she could have found, no one here who even knows the story. But she seems so sure, and something about that confidence in her deductions makes me want to tell her the truth. On paper, Rose is dangerous. A murderer. And I'm an accessory to her crime. But she doesn't feel like someone to fear. She feels like someone to trust. And that scares me. I let out a long breath, a thin stream of air between pursed lips. She was the opposite of you. I shake my head. Try again. She was someone I'd known for a long time. We met in college. She was the work hard, play hard type. She always wanted her life to look perfect, but she craved a bit of chaos underneath.
Can't say I blame her there,
Rose says as she swings along on her crutches beside me.
I mean, I live in a literal circus, for fuck's sakes. Not sure what's more chaotic than traveling across the country and riding around in the globe of death for a living.
At least that's chaos with a purpose. I think Claire's chaos was purely to fuck shit up and watch everyone else scramble in the aftermath. At the time, I thought she was exciting. She had this pristine life with an unpredictable twist. I thought she was what I wanted. I look across the street where kids are playing in a sprinkler on a lawn, their bikes discarded on the sidewalk. Further down, neighbors chat across a hedge, sharing a mid-morning beer. I know there is an underbelly of darkness in small towns just like in big cities. But something about Hartford feels comforting, even if it might be an illusion. Looking back, I'm not sure I knew what I wanted at all, so I came here to clear my head. Guess I'm still figuring it all out.
And how's that going for you?
I laugh, hiking the straps of our bags up higher on my shoulder. Up until a couple of weeks ago, it seemed to be going fine. And then the circus came to town and nothing's been the same since. Rose's eyes dance. The color warming to a dark amber hue in the summer sun.
I'm sorry about that.
I'm not, I reply. I catch the flicker of surprise across her face before she grins. I mean, it was kind of boring until you came around. Although you could make it slightly less boring, and I'd be okay with that.
But you have a drug-addicted raccoon that haunts your office. How boring could it possibly be?
You'd be surprised. We fall into a moment of silence, and though Rose usually fills those quiet chasms, this time she doesn't. It's as though she knows there's more I want to say, but she doesn't want to push me into it. I propose to her, I finally admit, something I don't usually share with anyone. She said no.
The raccoon?
I guffaw a laugh, and Rose's eyes sparkle with delight.
Such a shame. I would have loved to come to the wedding.
You could have been the officiant.
Even better.
The only caveat is that it would have been circus themed, so you'd have needed a clown costume.
Sign me the fuck up.
Our smiles slowly fade. Memories take hold in the silence. Pain dulls with time, but can still linger, waiting to be polished so it can shine once more.
I'm sorry that someone broke your heart,
Rose says, and her voice is so soft and melancholy that I look over at her. Thank you. I don't tell her I'm not sorry, that I spent a long time in mourning, not for losing Claire, but for how my whole reality seemed to shatter the moment I got down on one knee and she said no. I thought I loved her, and maybe I did love the idea of her. But more than that, I wanted the life I'd envisioned for us. A safe and secure and straightforward marriage. A surgical career in one of the best hospitals in the country. What my brothers had fought so hard and so long for me to have. A perfect life. Atonement for the sin I'd committed. A final twist of the key to lock my secret away. Proof that I am a good man, deserving of a good life. That moment I got down on one knee and Claire Peller said no, that she wanted a future with someone more exciting, darker, someone more real. It tore me apart. Just not in the way everyone believes. Maybe I was never deserving of all the things I thought I wanted. And that key, it just never turned. And I'm starting to wonder what would happen if I just opened the door.
Renegade. Rose. Fionn's sitting in the armchair, a bag of disgusting-looking dehydrated vegetable chips in his lap, his crochet project tucked at his side, his legs crossed at the ankles on the ottoman as a new reality dating show plays on his TV. His shorts come just above the knee, but they've ridden higher with the way he's sitting. Since when have I been attracted to a guy's legs? Since now, I guess. His are all tanned and muscly with just the right amount of hair that's bleached from all his time running in the sun. I want to touch them. But of course, I don't. I also want to tell him that it's so fucking sexy that he's sitting here with his yarn, not even hiding the fact that he's as into surviving love as I am. Why is that sexy? I have no fucking idea, but here we are.
Val and Mitchell better win this thing or I'm gonna be pissed,
he says as his favorite couple appears on the screen. I tamp down a grin, pretending to focus on my own crochet project, which I guess will be a sex swing after all, because why not? Sandra called the other day to let me know that her husband was making me a frame, even though it's probably not going to see much use since I'm on the driest dry spell ever. I think Danny and Renegade are going to win. Fionn snorts.
Renegade? What kind of fucking douchebag name is that?
A made-up one.
My point exactly. He deserves to lose for the name alone.
Hate it all you want, Doc. He's still going to win. Fionn gives me a piercing glare and I grin. God, I love that expression on him. When his eyes go lethal, their blue darkening to a deeper hue. There's a hunter in there somewhere. I just know it. I can imagine him letting that beast out to play. Chasing me. Catching me. Holding me down and tearing my clothes and... A notification comes through on Fionn's phone. A sound I don't recognize. He whips it from the side table and frowns at the screen. A look of shock passes over his face, and he darts to his feet, scattering his dried veggies across the floor.
Fucking Barbara!
He hisses. I grab a crutch and hop up onto my good foot. Yeah, fucking Barbara, let's fuck her up, I say, whipping my knife from the sheath at my back. Who's Barbara?
The raccoon.
I blink at him as Fionn pockets his phone and strides to the table to grab his truck keys. Aw, I don't want to fuck her up, she sounds cute.
Trust me, she's not so cute when she's gotten into the medication cabinet. Or the break room. Or basically anywhere.
Fionn marches to the door and throws it open, then turns to give me a questioning look over his shoulder.
Well, are you coming or what?
He smiles, and it's so bright, so beautiful, maybe even just a little bit unhinged, that I feel like I'm lit from the inside. I sheathe my knife and grab my other crutch and hobble toward him. His grin grows even more magnetic, a feat that doesn't seem possible. I pass him to step onto the landing, and before I can attempt the stairs, he sweeps me up with a strong arm across my waist and doesn't set me down until we're next to the truck.
She might look cute,
he says as he helps me up into the vehicle.
But don't let her deceive you. She'll tear your face off to get what she wants.
I force a mischievous grin as he settles my injured leg into the footwell, trying not to think about what it might be like for him to toss me around when he lifts me so effortlessly, or what his hands might feel like gripped so tightly to my hips that he leaves fingerprints on my skin. Are you talking about me or the raccoon? Fionn huffs.
Both, probably. So I guess you'll be evenly matched.
He tosses my crutches onto the back seat and jogs around to the driver's side, throwing the truck into reverse the moment it started so he can peel out of the driveway with a squeal of tires. So, how did you come to name a raccoon Barbara anyway? I ask as we turn onto Main Street.
Kind of randomly, to be honest. It just seemed to suit her.
Any idea how the hell she's getting into the clinic?
Witchcraft is my guess,
Fionn says as we watch a pair of state troopers drive in the opposite direction. We turn off Main Street and onto Stanley Drive, the side street where the clinic is located. I twist in my seat and watch as the troopers continue on their path.
They must be opening the search for Eric at Humboldt Lake. From what I heard, that's his favorite fishing spot.
I swallow. Where'd you hear that exactly?
One of the search volunteers. He came to my clinic yesterday.
Though I'm not looking at him, I can feel Fionn's eyes bore into the side of my face.
Why? What's wrong?
The shopkeeper at Shireton. He saw me and Eric talking when Eric bought bullets and I bought my knife. He knew Eric wasn't about to go fishing.
Gerald. Yeah, I know him.
Fionn's hand is a sudden warmth over mine, and I search his face when he breaks his gaze from the road to glance at me.
If Gerald was going to say something, he would have done it by now. Of anyone who could have drawn a connection between you and Eric, he's probably the least likely to bring that to the cops. He plays by the rules, but it doesn't mean he has any fondness at all for law enforcement. It'll be okay.
I sit back in my seat. I know enough about the area now to know that Humboldt Lake is about 20 miles out of Hartford, in the opposite direction of Weyburn. That puts it at least a good 40 or 50 miles from Eric's watery tomb at the bottom of the Platte River. By the time we park at Fionn's clinic, the burst of adrenaline from seeing the police vehicles has subsided. Maybe it's a false sense of security, but knowing the authorities are focusing their attention so far off course, I feel a measure of relief. I can't say Fionn feels the same. Not with the way his brows knit together, or the momentary pause he takes when he exits the vehicle to look back toward Main Street as though the cruisers might appear. When he comes to my side to help me down, the smile he gives me is a faint echo of the one from his doorstep only a few minutes ago.
Don't worry. As long as no one else realizes he was intending to hunt and not fish, he's going to be hard to find. And even if they do, who knows where he might have gone?
I'm not worried. I probably should be. I'm sure that's what Fionn is thinking too. But something about it feels right. No matter what happens next or what consequences I might have to face. Sometimes I think right might not be good, and wrong might not be bad. Even before I joined Silveria Circus, I'd started to question what kind of people drew those lines around our lives, and whose benefit those boundaries are really for. Because the more women I meet like me, the more I believe the rules were never made with us in mind. With a single decisive nod, Fionn passes me my crutches before grabbing a backpack from the rear seat. When we get to the entrance of the clinic, he brings up the app on his phone, disarming the security system before he checks each of the internal cameras.
I don't see her,
he says, as he pulls the keys from his pocket and unlocks the door. Is there a back entrance? I ask, and he nods. I'll take the keys and go in that way. We can corner her. Or, if we're lucky, she's already gone. Fionn levels me with a flat look as he drops the keys onto my waiting palm, and then slides the backpack from his shoulder to rummage through its interior. He passes me a pair of gardening gloves.
Trust me, she's not gone. She's lying in wait to ambush us.
Okay, I say as I shift my shoulders back. Where's the comms device? Fionn's eyes narrow as he hands me a beach towel. Walkie-talkie? Riot gear? Lasers? Surely you brought lasers, right? You're not expecting we can take down an assassin raccoon with nothing more than a towel, are you? Fionn pulls on his own gloves and sighs.
Just be careful.
Copy that. I grin at Fionn's exaggerated eye roll and pocket the keys before I pull the gloves on. With the towel tossed over my shoulder, I make my way to the back of the clinic, making note of any potential entry points where Barbara might be gaining access into the building. A vent near the peak of the roof catches my eye, and though the grill looks like it's in place, I'd be willing to bet money that she's figured out a way to get past it. You might be tricky, I say to myself as I unlock the door, but you're not circus-level tricky, Barbara. I step inside the air-conditioned building, shutting the door behind me with a quiet snick. The storage room I've entered is silent and dark. To my right, there are shelves with boxes of office supplies and latex gloves, masks, and paper towels. To my left is an unlit hallway that must lead toward the exam rooms. Marco, I call out as I flip on the storage room light. I lean my crutches against a wall and shift some boxes on a shelf, half expecting the raccoon to jump on my face. Marco? My phone buzzes in my pocket, and I pull off a glove and check the device.
Polo. Shh, she'll hear you.
Loosen up, McSpicy. You're worse than a bongo board in a blowdown.
I have no idea what that means.
You know, the tent master? In a circus? During a storm that blows all the tents down?
I'm still lost, but we'll come back to that later. Don't let Barbara sense your fear. It makes her more aggressive.
I grin at the screen and pocket the device before taking up my crutches and starting toward the corridor. And then I hear it, a rustling in the distance. I dart as fast as I can to the mouth of the darkened corridor and lock eyes with the raccoon. Barbara stands upright on her hind legs. Neither of us moves. She looks at me as though weighing her odds for coming out of a fight on top. And then, with her beady black eyes pinned to mine and her front paws folded against her chest, she walks on her back legs into the room at the end of the hall. Oh my God, that's both creepy and adorable. Barbara, get back here! I chase after the sound of her chattering call, losing my momentum when the towel slips from my shoulder and tangles around my crutches. There's a momentary clattering of tiny nails on stainless steel, but all has gone eerily quiet by the time I regain my balance and make it to the darkened threshold. When I hit the light switch and look around the staff break room, Barbara is nowhere to be seen. What the hell? Doc? Doc? Fionn's rushing footfalls draw to a halt just behind me.
No, Rose,
he says, his voice desperate.
She's drawn to sound.
I pivot to face him and roll my eyes. Doc, you make her sound like a fucking velociraptor.
Duck!
I turn just in time to see an angry ball of fur launching toward me from a shelf just above eye level. My crutches fall, my hands fly to my head, I dodge and spin on my good foot to watch as Barbara connects with Fionn's face. I toss the towel over them both.
Why?
The mound of squirming towel laments. Sorry, Doc, so sorry, I say, though it doesn't sound super sincere when I can't help but laugh. I grab what I hope is Barbara's scruff as she growls her protests and Fionn releases a string of Irish-accented expletives. As soon as I've got her pulled off his face, he stumbles backward, his hair disheveled and his neck red with bloodied, crisscrossed scratches.
What the fuck?
It worked, I reply with a shrug as Barbara continues to squirm in my grip. You're welcome.
I'm going to have to get rabies shots.
I turn Barbara toward me and she screeches and squirms, trying to take a swipe at my face. I mean, she doesn't look rabid, but I don't know shit about raccoons.
Well, I'm not going to take my chances and end up barking at my shadow. Thanks,
he says as he levels me with a stern look. When Barbara growls, Fionn's glare softens into worry. Even though he looks like he wants to hold on to his irritation, he can't seem to.
Let me take her for you.
Nah, I've got a good grip on her. I don't have faith this hostage transfer would go well. She is spicy, I say as she punctuates my words with frustrated barks. Just pass me a crutch and stuff one of those trail mix bags into my pocket. I nod toward a basket filled with very Fionn-esque healthy snacks. I'll let her out the back while you get your battle wounds cleaned up. Fionn's brows knit, a crease notched between them.
Are you sure?
It's the least I can do.
Thanks for taking a raccoon to the face for me.
Pyong can't help but snicker as he slides his gloves off and drops them on the counter. He takes the package of trail mix and hooks a finger into my pocket. Pyong Kane does not flirt with me, or at least he tries his best not to. But his eyes don't leave mine as he slides the treat into my pocket and says,
It wasn't really by choice, but I'd take a raccoon to the face for you any day, Rose Evans.
Blush rises in my cheeks as I smile, and I know he likes it. I can tell by the way his gaze drops to my lips and lingers there. I consider calling him out on it, throwing a question or two out into the open to see what happens next as he bends to retrieve one of my crutches. But before I have the chance, there are three loud knocks at the front door of the clinic. Fionn pats down his shorts, and that moment of unexpected playfulness vanishes from his eyes as they dart in the direction of the front of the building.
Shit, I left my phone at the front desk. I have no idea who that is.
I've got Barbara, don't worry about it. Go ahead, I'll be totally fine. He gives me a doubtful frown and three more knocks rap at the door. With an exchange of reluctant nods, we part ways, him toward the front of the clinic and me toward the rear with a single crutch and an irate trash panda. When I get to the back door, I wait until it's closed behind me before I lean the crutch against it, using my free hand to fish the trail mix from my pocket. I open it with my teeth and scatter the contents on the concrete walkway before setting Barbara down, using the towel as a flimsy barrier between us to keep her from backtracking and chomping on my legs. She looks like she considers it too, at least until I shoo her away in the direction of the food. With a final glare in my direction, she starts picking up peanuts and raisins with her dexterous little paws.
So cute, yet so murdery, I say, stuffing the gloves in my back pocket. I think we're kindred spirits, Barbara.
She growls. Right. Enjoy your snack. I'm totally going to tell Dr. McSpicy you're getting in through the vent for giving me that ungrateful attitude. She looks up at me with her beady little eyes. Okay, fine. I won't. But you need to check those manners next time. I leave the crusty raccoon to her meal, grabbing my crutch before I re-enter the clinic. I'm halfway down the hallway before a single text from Fionn stops me short.
Hide.
I dart into what must be Fionn's office as the light for the corridor flicks on, and a familiar voice booms from the direction of the waiting room.
Apologies, Dr. Kane. I know the clinic is closed and all, but I saw your truck out front and the lights on, so I thought I'd take my chances. It's just that my eye's a little sore, and I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just taking a quick look. Save me all the trouble of driving out to Weyburn.
Of course, Mr. Cranwell,
Fionn says, but his voice is pinched, his tone clipped.
We'll take exam room 2.
I linger in the shadows, staying out of sight in Fionn's office as he leads Matt to the exam room across the hall. My hand passes behind my back. I slowly pull my blade free of its sheath.
So, tell me about what happened,
Fionn says. Paper rustles as Matt gets up on the exam bed.
Long story, Dr. Kane. Not an entirely interesting one either. Got some cocktail sticks lodged in there.
You sure that doesn't make for an interesting tale?
Matt huffs a laugh, and the fine hairs at the back of my neck raise.
Maybe for another day.
Fionn hums a thoughtful note, and then there's silence, I imagine as he's pulling off the eye patch and examining the healing wound.
How long has it been since the injury?
He asks, despite knowing the answer.
About 3 weeks.
And you're still having pain?
Yes.
My hand tightens around my blade. That one simple word is delivered like a lie. I could give him real fucking pain. Take the other eye and make him beg for mercy. Realistically, would I probably puke everywhere if I did? Yes. But it would be worth it.
How's the farm?
Fionn asks, pulling me out of thoughts of murder and chaos.
Wife and kids? Same old, same old.
Matt replies, and there's a hidden thread of darkness in the jovial tone of his words, as though he's telling himself a clever joke.
How about yourself? Anything new and exciting in the world of Dr. Fionn Kane?
Fionn's reply is delivered with clinical detachment when he says,
Nothing much to report.
Matt chuckles.
My guts churn at the sound. I don't know whether to burst out of the shadows and slash Matt's fuck-ugly throat or chase after Barbara to hide out in her trash panda den.
That's not entirely true, is it? I understand you've got a visitor staying with you. Someone not from around here. A woman with a broken leg.
Word certainly does get around among small towns, doesn't it?
How'd she run into such a spell of trouble to wind up at your house?
Mr. Cranwell.
Fionn says on a sigh.
You know, I'm not at liberty to discuss a patient with you.
I'm not asking about her condition. I'm asking about how she got there.
Considering she's not here to answer for herself, I'm not about to detail her circumstances to someone she's never met.
There's a pause. I imagine Fionn giving him a stern look. I can picture, with perfect clarity, the way his eyes can turn as sharp as the cutting edge of a polished gem. So beautiful, but still able to draw blood.
It wouldn't be very professional of me, would it? You're right. You're right.
Matt concedes, though his submission is not convincing.
I'm just looking out for you, making sure you're all right.
Why wouldn't I be?
You just never know who you might be dealing with, that's all. Outsiders can cause trouble.
No more so than insiders. Isn't that right?
I know Fionn well enough to know that I've never heard him sound like this. The words are simple, direct. They're delivered with coolness, an eerie sense of calm. But beneath them is an undercurrent, a lethality, a warning to stay away, or else. I might not be able to see their faces, but the tension between the two men feels ready to ignite. A curtain of unease descends, thick enough that I'm sure I could cut it with the blade clutched in my hand.
Your post-operative recovery seems to be going well. There are no signs of infection or swelling,
Fionn finally says. His voice is still cool, but it's lost the deadly bite in the tone.
I'll prescribe some tramadol for you.
No need, Dr. Kane,
Matt says.
I'd better stay alert. You know, busy time of year and all. I've got to stay vigilant, on my toes.
Fionn says nothing. I imagine the deferential nod he probably gives Matt, the way he watches and considers and gives only what he needs to in a tense situation. He'll be careful, calm, but he'll be roiling under that detached exterior. I know there's another side to him, buried beneath what he lets me see. And this time I can feel it, lingering in the air like musk. I shift farther into the shadows when I hear footsteps, coming face to face with a photo of Fionn and two other men who have similar features. Dark hair, high cheekbones, shining smiles. Blue eyes, each shade unique, the color of Fionn's the lightest of them all. They link arms over one another's shoulders. There's brothers in Boston, Rowan and Lachlan, whom he's spoken of only briefly. I step closer to the photo as a set of curt goodbyes reaches me from the entrance. Even in a moment frozen in time, I can see the love and happiness that radiates from each of them. And Fionn has come all this way, chosen to separate himself from his brothers and his home, just for a chance to heal a broken heart. Maybe a chance to hide the side of himself he doesn't want anyone to see. What if I'm tearing his sanctuary apart? The front door of the clinic closes, and a moment later, Fionn returns. I realize before I exit his office that I recognize him by the cadence of his steps alone. He stops in front of me, and I try to smile. But guilt is starting to chew a little hole in my heart.
Are you okay?
He asks, his brow furrowed, his eyes pinned to mine. Yeah, are you? I don't know what I expect him to say, but I know for sure that the last thing I expect is for him to wrap me in an embrace. His arms are tense around me, protective and sheltering. I'm so surprised that it takes a moment for me to return the gesture. As soon as I do, his heart jumps a beat beneath my ear. A little of the tension in Fionn subsides, as though he didn't realize how much he needed this too. Something about that aches in my chest. Maybe I tighten my grip around him just a little, press my face to his chest a little harder, close my eyes as I take in his scent, sage and citrus, warmed by the sun. There's maybe a hint of raccoon, too, but I let that slide. with a faint smile. We stay like that for a long while. When we separate, Fionn checks the front door of the clinic, making sure Matt is long gone before he beckons me to follow. He lifts me into the truck like he always does. He seems nervous to drop me off at home, where I'll be alone, but after at least 5 or 6 reassurances that I'll be okay, he leaves for the hospital to get his first rabies shot. It isn't until later that evening, when I'm lying in bed and staring into the dark, that I realize something. He never answered my question. I don't know if he's really okay.
Beast mode. Fionn. The lights are low. Music pumps through the speakers. The smell of sweat and beer and bourbon permeates the air as I make my way through the crowd. My grip tightens on the handle of my bag, and I push past the people talking and laughing as they wait for the show to begin. Maybe I shouldn't like this environment. I know what's about to come after all. It's not really the kind of thing a man like me should condone. But the truth is, I love coming to these blood brothers fights. The split flesh to mend, a glimpse of bone. It's raw and visceral. This is humanity at its bloody core, fights hidden in the dark. My job might be on the sidelines, to fix the damage done during the bare-knuckle fights in a makeshift ring in a rundown barn, but I enjoy it nonetheless. I'm close enough to feel the adrenaline of the battles and rivalries, and just far enough that I don't become a different man from the one I chose to be. And maybe it will take my mind off Rose. I can't deny how much I want her. Every day, little by little, it gets worse. Her infectious smile. Her uninhibited laugh. Her wild, unpredictable nature, as though she's not bound by the same rules as everyone else. She's so fucking beautiful, it sometimes hurts just to look at her. The way she sits at the table to stare into her tarot cards with a braid looped over her shoulder and her fringe skimming her brows. The way her eyes sparkle when she teases me. No matter how hard I try not to let it, my desire for her chews at my resolve. But I feel like I'm losing my grip on reality. Like I'm not the man I thought I could force myself to be. And that makes me infinitely more dangerous than she is. Because while Rose knows what she is and what she wants and how dark she's willing to be, I still have no idea what I'm truly capable of. Or what will happen if I let myself go. I can't risk her. I can't. I need some time to figure this all out. Time around something that gets me out of my own head and into the blood and guts of life. When I make it to the side of the ring, my designated area, I set my bag down on the folding table and take out my white coat and stethoscope and put them on. I learned early on to do this first, or risk being punched in the face for taking up prime real estate next to the ropes. As soon as they're on, I wipe down the table and take out the things I know I'll need, placing them on a sterile disposable mat, isopropyl alcohol, cotton pads, a scalpel, latex gloves, my suture kit. "Dr. Kane," Tom says in his best announcer voice, sidling up to my table as I nudge my 2 metal stools into place next to the table. He gives me a flash of a chipped smile when I meet his eyes, his gaze traveling across the crowd before returning to me. This is his show, his lair, and he revels in every moment of the mayhem. "We've got quite a lineup tonight. I'm sure you're going to be busy." "I'm always busy when I come here."
"Maybe extra busy this time," Tom says with a wink. "Fury and the Natural are up first. You ready?"
A spike of excitement snakes through my veins. I nod once. "Sure am, Tom."
"Great."
He claps me on the shoulder. Then he turns to the ring, bringing a microphone to his lips.
"Who in this shithole is ready for a fight?"
he booms, his words chased by cheers and pounding feet and sloshing beer. I've been here enough times over the last few years that I have this process memorized. Tom introduces the fighters. The packed audience yells their bets. They wave money in the air. Tom's grown kids and a handful of employees collect wagers. And as Tom booms the limited rules through the microphone, I ready myself. I'm coiled, even though I'm not the one about to fight. The match starts and I shift my feet on the sticky floor like I'm a mirror of the battle on the mats. When the natural throws a hook, my fist tenses. When Fury ducks to avoid a punch, my head bobs too. The fight goes the full 3 rounds. I patch the natural up with a few butterfly bandages after the second, just enough to keep the blood from dripping into his eye, but by the end of the match, he's heading straight to me for stitches, the pain likely made a little duller by his narrow win in the ring. His buddy brings him 2 beers and he chokes the first one. I don't even bother mentioning that now is probably the worst time for alcohol, given he needs at least 6 sutures. I just disinfect the wound and start my work, piercing his skin and drawing the thread through the tiny bloody hole I create, tying each stitch with a precise knot. I'm only 3 stitches in when a familiar voice grinds my progress to a sudden halt.
Hey, Doc.
My heart surges into my throat and lodges there as I whip my head around and come eye to eye with Rose. She sinks a bite into a hot dog overflowing with mustard and relish and ketchup. Her eyes glimmer in the dim light as they take in the shock that must be spread across my face. Rose, what the fuck are you doing here? She shrugs, taking her time to chew and swallow before she wipes her mouth and gives me a mischievous grin.
Thought I might check out what y'all do for fun around these parts. The Suture Sisters are cool and all, but I figured crochet club and the gym weren't your only hobbies.
She glances around us and returns her gaze to mine with a shrug.
Guess I was right.
You're supposed to be at Sandra's, I protest, a wave of worry hitting me so hard I feel nauseated.
I was at Sandra's for a bit, but I got bored. One can only work on a sex swing for so long, I guess.
She replies with a shrug. How did you get here?
Larry?
An irrational spike of anger hits my chest like a lightning strike. Who the fuck is Larry? Her head tilts.
Chill, Doc. You're touchier than a Risley juggler with athlete's foot.
I'm... what? Rose rolls her eyes at my inability to decipher her obscure circus lingo.
You're irritable.
I open my mouth to protest, but she's already shifted gears when she says,
You don't know Trucker Larry? He's your neighbor, 6 houses down across the street.
For a moment, I consider lying and claiming I know who the hell she means. But that won't fly with Rose. She merely grins around another bite of her hot dog and pierces me with her sharp, dark eyes.
Have you been living in Hartford, Doc? Or have you just been hiding out in it?
My gaze drops from hers as I turn her words over in my mind. I know she's right, of course, but it feels different to hear it from someone on the outside. I've had my head down, doing my work, keeping to myself. If a person hasn't come into the clinic, chances are I haven't gotten to know them. And even if they've been to my practice, can I say I've really made many friends in town? This Blood Brothers Fight Club is the closest thing I've had to socialization until I wound up with the Suture Sisters, and even this is realistically more of a job than it is a night off with friends. A job. I finally realize I'm here to suture somebody's face, and the gash across his brow is only half stitched up. Sorry, I grumble as I turn back to my patient. No need to apologize, Dr. Kane. The guy says as I slide my curved suture needle through his skin. I'd rather look at her pretty face than mine too if I were in your position.
Nah, you're the prettiest one here, Nate.
Rose says, adding accelerant to the fire that's already burning through my veins. I turn my incredulous glare to Rose, who gives me a saccharine smile as she wipes her fingers clean then tosses the napkin into a nearby bin. She grips the handles of her crutches and points one in my patient's direction.
Wait, you're telling me you don't know Nate either? Nate the Natural? He makes those wicked cool chainsaw wood sculptures all over town. The bear is badass, Nate.
Thanks, Rose. Nate only grins when I narrow my eyes at him, and pierce his brow a little more roughly than necessary for the next stitch. I try not to glance over at Rose as I concentrate on the work of my hands, and Nate can see it, my struggle to keep my attention where it belongs. So he takes every opportunity to ask Rose questions about her broken leg or her tarot cards, or, worst of all, how long before you're back on the road with the circus? Last one, I interject before Rose has a chance to answer. I tie the final knot and clip the thread free, then rise from my stool. See you around. Nate gives me a slow smile that's equal parts teasing and pitying. Thanks, man, he says, shaking my hand before he turns away. Rose, stop by my shop next Sunday, and I'll have something for you. No, you won't, I grumble, but no one can hear me over the drone of the crowd. I clean up my workstation, but really I hang on every word Rose says as she agrees to visit Nate's shop and compliments the new scar on his brow before giving him a brief hug. Even after Nate's moved out of my peripheral vision, I still don't look over at Rose. Instead, I busy myself with resetting my table, but I feel her dark eyes on me the entire time. I finally set down the last item, a fresh curved needle, when Rose says,
You okay there, Doc?
No. Yeah, all good.
You sure?
You shouldn't be here, I blurt out. It feels like all the sound is sucked out of the room. Like I could pick Rose's voice out of the chaos, but her silence is just as loud. When I finally look up, she has her arms crossed despite leaning on her crutches, and it looks as fierce as it does awkward.
Why not?
It's not safe. Rose casts her gaze around us in an arc that sweeps across the ceiling and the crowd before returning to me.
Yeah, structurally, this place is probably not great. One dodgy bolt and we'll all be crushed to death by rotten beams and broken dreams.
I give Rose a flat glare and mischief dances across her face. You know what I mean. It's not safe for you, your leg, this crowd, the person who could show up, if you know what I mean.
You mean Matt? He's busy making hay. Lucy's younger sister's best friend's boyfriend told me at the car wash today.
What were you doing at the car wash? You don't have a car.
I was bored, thought I'd take a little wander and got to talking.
She says, unaware that two men have started a shoving match behind her, one pushing the other against the side of the empty ring before they're separated by their respective friends.
Anyway, this place seems just fine to me.
You hurtle yourself through a metal cage on a death machine, and you subsist on a diet of waffles and sugar. I can't say I trust your self-preservation instincts. Rose lifts a shoulder and takes a lollipop from her pocket, holding my gaze as she slowly pulls the wrapper free and slides it past her lips. Those fucking lips. Strawberry red, glistening, sweet and plump. I can almost feel them, warm and yielding as they wrap around my...
Next up is the Humphrey Hurricane, Tom booms into his microphone.
Cheers and boos interrupt the ache that's already starting to build in my cock. I shake my head, trying to clear my thoughts and refocus on my purpose for being here.
And please welcome a brand new challenger to the ring, Ballistic Bill.
The crowd descends into a frenzy of betting and shouting as the new guy ducks between the ropes and throws his hands in the air, turning a slow circle as he basks in the mayhem. He's fucking enormous. He shrugs off his black robe and he's like a square block of muscle and tattoos. Shaved head, wrapped hands, scarred face. This guy knows what he's doing. And I've seen the Hurricane fight. I've stitched him up. He's capable and fast, light on his feet. But I know the same thing the rest of the crowd does. The Hurricane is about to have his ass handed to him. Rose, seriously, you need to get out of here, I say over the cheers as Ballistic Bill roars like a feral beast. The crowd surges and a drunken onlooker bumps into Rose's crutch as though proving my point. He sloshes a few drops of beer on her arm and it takes everything in me to swallow down a burst of rage as he apologizes to her before moving away. It's not safe here. Fights break out on the sidelines all the time. You don't have anywhere to put your foot up.
Chill, Doc.
Rose brushes off the drops of alcohol and then hobbles toward me. She taps my hip with her crutch and I rise from the stool, internally berating myself for not giving her my seat earlier, though it's not like I want to encourage her to stay. As soon as I'm up, she plops herself down, then brings her injured leg onto the empty stool.
See? All good. Promise I'll move when you get your next patient. The hurricane, by the looks of things. Yikes.
Rose.
You should get us something from the grease joint.
She nods toward the concession stand when I tilt my head and furrow my brow at what must be more of her circus lingo.
I wouldn't mind a beer. I'll hold down the fort and make sure nobody takes your doctory shit. If they do, I'll stab them in the fucking eye.
Rose whips my scalpel from the table and stabs an invisible assailant, twisting the blade, a look of maniacal glee plastered on her face. I cover her hand with mine and pry the knife from her grasp. Please do not go stabbing anyone, I say as I take a sterile pad and disinfect the handle before setting it back in its place. I'm only going to be the one to put them back together again if you do. Rose shrugs as though that's not her problem. One beer.
Might as well bring two. Save you another trip.
One. You're recovering. I'm your doctor. Doctor's orders. Some fleeting wisp of emotion passes across Rose's face, the meaning of it too complex for me to discern from her furrowed brow before it smooths.
Fine, but I'll take a bag of Skittles too. Please?
I don't think they have Skittles.
Trust me, they do.
Though I roll my eyes, we both know I won't deny her. It's hard enough not to bring an entire keg back for her just so she can have the two beers she wants while I keep her in sight. She grins at me as though she can read my thoughts. I shake my head at her, but when I turn my back and walk away, I smile. The bartender sees me coming and I'm able to jump the line, grabbing the Skittles and a free beer and a bourbon for myself before I return to the table just in time for the start of the fight. Tom yells the rules into the mic, closed fist only, no slapping, no elbows, no knees or kicking. Anyone knocked down has 10 seconds to get back up. And then he steps back from between the two fighters, and with one simple word, the battle is on. Fight. The crowd roars as the hurricane lunges forward with a hook that doesn't connect. Ballistic Bill leans away from a cross jab. And another. Another. A punch finally connects, but only with Bill's arm as he blocks his face. He dodges more hits, allowing a few past his defenses, always leaning away just as a punch connects. The blows he lets through are nothing more than taps. The crowd cheers and heckles and shouts at both men. But Bill doesn't seem to notice. He's only focused on his opponent, his feet light and quick on the blood-stained mats despite his massive size. And he hasn't thrown a single punch.
He's wearing him out,
Rose says over the din of the audience, not looking away from the fight. She gestures toward the ring with a skittle.
The hurricane is so fucked.
Dread settles in my guts like a stone. Most fights here might be raw, but they're at least evenly matched. Not this time. And she's right. I can feel it in my marrow. The hurricane is fucked. I turn my attention back to the ring just as Bill delivers his first hit, a punch to the hurricane's ribs. He stumbles backward. Bill clips his cheek with a jab. The hurricane buries his head behind his forearms and blocks a few more punches. The crowd eats it up. But it's obvious. Bill barely follows through, hardly uses his shoulders. He doesn't put the momentum of his weight into the fight. These hits are only for show. The buzzer rings, ending the first 2-minute period. The fighters head back to their corners, where their buddies or amateur trainers pass them water and towels, leaning close to each man to deliver strategy or encouragement. Excitement skitters through the audience. I look down my shoulder at Rose and find she's already watching me, a grin etched into her face as she tilts her beer bottle in my direction.
This is great, Doc. Thanks for bringing me here.
I frown. I didn't. I asked you to leave.
multiple times.
I thought we were friends,
she says with a sarcastic pout, but there's something about it that seems like genuine disappointment. The expression disappears in an instant as she turns her attention away from me to add her voice to the chorus of shouts around us as Tom calls for the fighters to return to the center of the ring. But I'm still looking at Rose, and it takes longer than it should to tear my gaze away. The buzzer rings, the fight resumes. This time, Bill puts in a little more effort. He punches with more force. When the Hurricane loses stamina and backs away, Bill is on him, pushing him into the ropes. The newcomer is unrelenting, one blow after the next. The Hurricane takes successive hits to the ribs, and when his arms inch lower and his frame hunches, Bill is there. A huge left hook slips right through his defenses and slams into the other man's jaw. The Hurricane's back hits the mat and he doesn't get up. Cheers and boos swell around us as the seconds are counted. The Hurricane barely stirs, his body splayed across the mat. When the match is finally called in his favor, Bill takes a victory lap around his opponent and then slips through the ropes to collect his winnings. I take his place to collect my patient. Hey, buddy, we're gonna need to get you to the hospital, I say over the roar of the crowd as I kneel next to the Hurricane. He blinks his swollen eyes up at me, and I pull him into the recovery position. His friends pat his shoulder and keep him conscious as I turn my attention to Tom, the announcer hovering in the periphery. What the fuck, man? Tom flashes a smile that might as well be made of dollar signs.
Great fight, wasn't it? The crowd is going nuts.
You and I might have different definitions of great.
Everyone who steps into this ring knows they might leave it on a stretcher.
And everyone who steps into it should be matched so they won't fucking die. The longer our eyes stay locked in a silent exchange, the more Tom's smile dissolves. We both know that if I accuse him of rigging this fight with a ringer, there will be more trouble in this barn than either of us can handle. Tom knows I don't like it, but he also knows I won't risk lighting a fuse in a powder keg. His smile sneaks back onto his face when he says,
Don't pretend you don't enjoy a little mayhem, Dr. Kane. Why else would you keep coming back?
Because if you insist on running this club of yours, someone qualified needs to be here to put the fighters back together, I say, as the Hurricane's friends get him up on his unsteady feet. Because they're going to wind up worse off if I don't. Or someone will end up dead because... Whatever half-truth I'm about to bark at Tom evaporates the moment I hear Rose scream. I forget about my patient, the crowd, the lights, and the noise. When I whip around, all my focus is on the place she should be, the place where she is not. My table is shifted, my supplies scattered across its surface. One of Bill's friends tries to hold him back as he scraps with two other men, a third stumbling away from the altercation with his hand raised to catch the blood that trickles from a gash over his eye. Where is she? I call out her